Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back my guest co-host, Dr. Leah Ranney. Welcome, Leah.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you back. You know, we have a great talk today with Dr. Andrea Ascarati-Perrell, the director of UNC's Microbiome Research Corps, about the microscopic organisms that live inside us. I'm going to just disclose, I've taken some probiotics before. Have you ever taken probiotics?
Absolutely. I used to take them on a regular basis.
We're going to be talking about probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, a lot of words that we're not even sure what type of biotics they are, but things that are important to our microbiome, our gut, where there are apparently billions of bacteria that we need to know about, and we may be able to promote the good bacteria. I'm excited about this. But first, we have research that matters that I'm also excited about. The first one is a kind of a sobering research about silent heart attacks. What are we talking about when we say silent heart attacks, Leah?
It's the heart attacks that occur that do not follow the typical symptoms, such as grabbing your chest, pain in your arm, but they are just as dangerous, just as damaging as other heart attacks.
Yeah, and this research that was in the American Heart Association's journal Circulation says about half of all heart attacks may be silent. And this was research where they looked at almost 10,000 middle-aged adults that were being followed for kind of their risk of developing heart problems. And they looked at the heart attack differences between men and women and blacks and whites. And over about 10 years of the start of the study of these 10,000 people, a little over 300 had these silent heart attacks, and closer to 400 had these heart attacks with clinical symptoms. So it really suggests that these silent heart attacks do occur and that they increase the chance of dying from heart disease. They increase the overall mortality, not just from heart disease, and they were more common in men but more likely to cause death in women. I guess that's the bad news. Is there any silver lining in this? What do you think, Leah? How would you interpret perhaps this sort of study? If you got risk factors, let's say we have high blood pressure or high cholesterol or we're overweight or not physically active.
Well, I certainly would visit my physician annually and listen to what my physician says in regards to anything from my smoking or drinking behaviors and my diet, which are risk factors for heart attack.
Right. I think you're spot on here. This is about changing our risk factors, doing what we can do, because we can't say, oh, I can just wait till I have a symptom of a coronary blockage and then go in and get my vessel dilated or have my bypass surgery. Kind of a false assumption if half of these times it's occurring silently. More important to really manage your risk factors. Good advice. I agree with it entirely. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, which is about another aspect of things that raise risk, but this time we're not talking about heart disease. We're talking about risk of Alzheimer's and the links between that risk and the type of diet that is prevalent in the United States. What's this about?
Again, it's about our thinking about our risk factors in terms of nutrition and exercise, and more importantly, what are we eating?
Yeah, and in this particular case, what they're really looking at is the link between eating of diets that are heavy in meat consumption versus diets that are heavy in vegetable consumption. And I know Christy Page and myself, we've talked over a number of years about the links in various diseases and the encouragement of diets that are lower in animal fats and higher in fresh fruits, vegetables, and whole grains because of the reduction in risk. And this is actually another, I think, a nail that says that these things are real. And this particular one looked in 10 different countries, different literature, and looked at kind of the rates of dietary meat that they were consuming and rates of Alzheimer's, and basically found what?
Well, they did find that diets, first, this is a great international study with a lot of information from other types of diets across the world, but they did find that meats, diets high in meats and high-fat dairy products, sweets, are associated with increased Alzheimer's risk.
Yeah, and this was actually published in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition, and basically suggest that there is a strong benefit. We know that Mediterranean-type diets lower the risk of Alzheimer's disease, and there appears to be an additional risk reduction by eating low consumption of meats, which is not necessarily always in the Mediterranean diet. One could kind of do this. So you could get even an additional lowering of risk. So I think these are important things that people can decide of how they may want to incorporate it and certainly talk with their doctor. Speaking of diet and weight, a link between maybe our last two studies is our next research that matters about the linkage between excess weight, obesity, and cancer. Because we've talked about linkage between some types of cancers. I think this research really is, let's stand up and notice it. What does it tell us, Leah?
Well, this research was based on 1,000 studies of excess weight and cancer risk. And so it is telling us that there is a clear link between weight and certain cancers, such as obesity, stomach, liver, gallbladder, pancreas, ovarian, and some brain tumors.
Yeah, this was actually in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it extended what we really know looking at the literature from the risk of esophagus, kidney, breast, and uterus, which we think are the common cancers that are related to obesity, to a whole host of additional cancers. Probably not surprising when we think about the hormonal changes, that why obesity promotes cancer. Why would it be only limited to certain organs or some organs? We see when you're having a cancer-causing agent like tobacco in the chemicals, it hits multiple organs. And the changes associated with obesity are equally pervasive in terms of some of these different organs here. So I think this is a kind of one of these aha moments that not only do we want to promote optimal weight and physical activity to reduce heart disease, really cancer is now a major issue.
I agree.
And I think if we have loved ones or patients, it's something that we can have a conversation. Finally, let's talk about our last research that matters. And I think this is really important, and particularly in light of we're going to be having a great conversation with Dr. Andrea Asgarati-Perel in a little while about probiotics and trying to, I guess, reduce antimicrobial resistance, particularly in our environment. And this suggests that there's a direct link potentially between this antibiotic resistance genes and the antimicrobial chemicals perhaps in some common products. What do you think, Leah?
It's a little bit scary because we're not sure exactly what products that this antimicrobial chemical is in.
Yeah, this was looking at this chemical called triclosan, which is apparently in a variety of different common products, including in the antimicrobial soaps that are now being regulated, banned by the Food and Drug Administration. And this was found in these, not only in the chemicals, but this antibiotic-resistant genes in the dust of an aging building that was used for athletics and academics, which suggests that these things are related, that the actions by the Food and Drug Administration are probably in the right direction. And I think it's the type of research we want to talk about with our great colleague today to find out what we can do to cut down on antibiotic resistance, but also promote our good bacteria. And it's probably, as I bet she'll end up saying, not trying to get rid of all bacteria, but probably trying to just keep our good bacteria and promote that good bacteria's health.
I'm certain she will say that.
Well, let's take a listen. We're going to take a short break. But when we return, we actually will be talking with Dr. Andrea Asgarati-Perel, the director of UNC's Microbiome Research Corps, about the human microbiome and the microscopic organisms that live within us. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Leah Ranney. Today on Conversations, Leah, we're talking with Dr. Andrea Ascarati-Perel, the director of UNC's Microbiome Research Corps and assistant professor of cell biology and physiology in the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about the human microbiome. Welcome, Dr. Ascarati-Perel.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You know, it's great to have you on the show today, and I know we're going to dissect each of those words in our title, because our listeners might be going, microbiome, research core, cell biology, and human, you know, those are complicated words. But first off, I think let's just make it real simple. Tell us about yourself and how you became interested in this particular topic of understanding what might be considered a core issue of humans.
So I've worked with probiotics for over 20 years now. So probiotics are good beneficial bacteria that will have a beneficial impact on humans and animals. And so for me, it was very natural to transition to, okay, what happens with the whole community of bacteria, the whole community of microorganisms, when you introduce a beneficial bacteria? I also work with prebiotics. Prebiotics are like the food for the good bacteria in your gut. So that's what it attracted, you know, attracted me to this topic. Is I work with probiotics, I work with prebiotics, and then the tools to understand these very complex communities became available. And for me, it was like very natural to transition to this.
But you didn't just wake up one day somewhere in your early 20s and say, I want to be a researcher and study the microbiome. Where did this interest come from?
I'm a microbiologist.
So you got your PhD in microbiology.
In microbiology.
And somewhere in that path, you really became interested. Why that topic, though?
The microbiome? Mm-hmm. Because it's so central to our health. It's so central to our health. And the more research we do, the more I read about what other researchers are doing, the more respect I have for the bacteria. You know, bacteria were here before we even came here. So they colonized the Earth. Then we came, and they colonized us, if you will.
This is fascinating work, and I see the importance of it, because every part of our body has some type of bacteria. And when we think of the word sometimes bacteria, we think about something negative. But mm-hmm. in fact, from your research and others, that we do know that there's a lot of positive bacteria and positive things about bacteria.
Well, there's so I've worked with beneficial bacteria my whole life. I know that a lot of researchers doing microbiology research, they concentrate on pathogens, so bacteria that cause disease. But there are a lot of bacteria that are either commensals, meaning that they don't have an either a detrimental or a beneficial impact, or beneficial bacteria. And the more we learn about the gut bacteria, the more we know that they do have a function, and that normally if that bacteria is absent, we're going to have a problem. So,
you know, I'm going back to medical school now, and I'm trying to think back. Did I ever hear a message that there were good bacteria in our body? And I may have heard that, but I remember, and of course, this is the definition of the word dis-ease. It's, mm-hmm. it's something abnormal that needs to be corrected. And all of microbiology was about really studying the organisms that cause dis-ease. When did you begin to, and did you understand this from the beginning, to know that, and how many beneficial bacteria are there compared to those that cause disease?
Let me tell you something. I do not believe, I don't know if believe is the word, but I do not believe that there is such thing as pathogens. There are bacteria in the wrong place at the wrong time trying to survive. In that process, they can cause disease. Now, and it's the same thing with beneficial bacteria.
I want to stop 1 second. What do you mean bacteria in the wrong place at the wrong time? Tell us what you mean by that, and then sorry.
Well, that could be when we talk about opportunistic pathogens, for example, when you have C. difficile, Clostridium difficile, you have to wipe out the entire microbiota with antibiotics. And that happens normally in the elderly. They are given antibiotics and then they get C. difficile infections, right? Is the wrong bacteria in the bacteria in the wrong place at the wrong time? If that person had a healthy microbiota, probably he would not have, he would not contract that disease. If that makes sense. So, and then going back to beneficial bacteria, this is not something new. This is 1908. Eli Metchnikoff is considered the father of the probiotics. He said, we can modulate, you know, the bacteria in our guts because that bacteria is dependent of what we eat. Of course, he also said the intestines were the source of putrefaction and we needed to just cut it out. But, of course, we're not going to consider that.
We won't remember that part of what
he
said.
Yeah, no. But this is not new, you know. This is from 1908. We knew. And that came from working with yogurt, you know, and Bulgarian peasants consuming yogurt and fermented foods, which were very beneficial for the intestinal health.
So beyond yogurt, are there any ways that we can continue to keep our bodies healthy or keep our bacteria healthy or out of the wrong place at the wrong time?
Yes, there is. So a lot of fermented foods and real food. What do I mean by real food? You know, just get vegetables, raw vegetables, eat raw vegetables, cook at home, don't eat junk food, don't eat processed food. Not only because it has a lot of harmful ingredients, but also because it's completely devoid of bacteria. You know, when you take a tomato and you cut and make a salad, you cut it and you make a salad, you know, the knife that you use have bacteria in it. The surface of the tomato, even of course you wash it, but it has bacteria in it and is perfectly, you know, bacteria that it is not harmful. It just is there. So we need to feed and refeed our gut microbiota.
So it's our own gut isn't static.
No, it is not.
So how does it change? You mentioned that someone obviously taking antibiotics, and we now all worry. I know as a doctor, I worry all the time. I've seen Clostridium difficile so many times from people when they come in the hospital or they've been given antibiotics, common antibiotics, and they get this. What else do we need to know about this static, not static of our gut? You mentioned eating raw vegetables. That helps to keep it, I guess, healthy.
Yes. So the research about the microbiota being static versus not being static is kind of contradicting. So at the beginning, we thought we were going to find a core microbiome, you know, a group of bacteria that would be common to the whole humanity and that would be constant and static. That is not the case. However, there are bacteria that will colonize you when you are a baby that can stay your whole life. So it's static to an extent. And, you know, if it has a grave perturbation like antibiotics, it will go back to an homeostatic, to an equilibrium. But that equilibrium may be different to what you had before, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's very static and at the same time it's very dynamic.
Well, we're going to really continue this conversation and perhaps get some tips here about your research. What's the cutting edge of the work you're doing? What do we know about probiotics? Should we be taking them? Should we take them when we have antibiotics? Should our children be exposed routinely? If you drop some food on the floor, what should you do? All these kinds of questions that are practical questions that I know I have questions about. But we do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with Dr. Andrea Ascarati-Perro, the director of the University of North Carolina's Microbiome Research Corps and assistant professor of cell biology and physiology in the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about the human microbiome. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Leah Ranney. Today on Conversations, Leah, we've been talking with Dr. Andrea Ascarati-Perrell, the director of UNC's Microbiome Research Center, about the human microbiome. And Dr. Ascarati-Perrell, I think we'd like to know a little bit about your research. And what are the things that you're working on? Are you doing work with children and brain development and how the microbiome may be related? Because I know that we laugh right before the break that when you drop something on the floor, which we now tell, it's okay if it's less than 30 seconds, you know, you can pick it up. That exposure isn't a bad exposure. What do we know about that in children?
So we are conducting some research with Dr. Rebecca Santelli, and she's actually the head of that project, the lead of that project. And this project entitles Understanding How the Microbial Composition of the Gut of a Baby When It's 1 Year Old Impacts the Cognitive Development. So this is what was found out in the study, and is that we studied the gut microbiota of these babies when they were 1 year old, and then she studied them. She did MRIs and other studies and other tests to see their communication skills when they were 2 years old. And what she found out is that there is a correlation between the gut microbiota and communication skills at year two. And why is this relevant? Because these skills can be affected in disorders like autism and other brain disorders.
I thought that was a fascinating part of your work. Could you tell us a little bit more about how the microbiomes and autism are connected?
From studies in animals, we know that the gut microbiota is related to several disorders, that behavior, exploratory disorder, depression, anxiety. Mm-hmm. With humans, we know that the gut microbiota is altered in individuals with autism and individuals with depression. So I believe that until now, for the last 5 years or so, the microbiome, the science of microbiome, has been very descriptive. So we try to associate, this disease, what happens with the gut microbiota? Is it the same or is it different? And now we're moving on to more exciting research where we can understand why and make real breakthroughs on how to treat certain diseases. So the research in children is particularly exciting because we can provide the information to establish a healthy gut microbiota right from the beginning to prevent other disorders later, like asthma, like allergies, like Crohn's disease, like IBD, like IBS, that sort of.
So you think, and let me see if I'm getting this correct, you're suggesting that it's one thing to say, oh, if we wipe out all the gut, we get Clostridium difficile. And we know if we preserve the gut, we may not get that. It's another thing to say, we might be able to take a probiotic to prevent that problem for someone who needs antibiotics. And then there seems like to me you're extending that and say, oh, we might be able to promote good bacteria so that the disease never happens, or maybe we could treat the disease not with antibiotic, but by promoting the good bacteria. Are you suggesting all of those things?
All of those things. Before, so like I said, I started probiotics for over 20 years now. But when I started my PhD, probiotics were these things that people would believe or not, even scientists, you know. And the gut microbiota was a black box. You know, we knew that for some people probiotics worked, for other people, it didn't do anything. But we are at a point that we have now the information, and we can understand the networks and what happens in your gut and why those probiotics work for some people and not for other people, and why prebiotics, which is essentially, you know, like the food for the probiotics, why they work in some people and they don't work in other people. And that's the research I'm interested in. I work specifically with galactoligosaccharides, which is a prebiotic. But if you don't have one specific bacteria in your gut that is able to use that prebiotic, it's not going to work for you.
Hmm. And you've mentioned, I think I've seen somewhere, billions and billions of gut bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
How do you narrow that down? You're the director of this microbiome core. Maybe you can tell us what this microbiome core does, and how do you begin to narrow down these billions of different possibilities into what I might call a core set of things that you are so excited about, we need to know about?
Narrow down. Huh. That's
a
wish.
It's a limitless process, right?
That's a wish. It's very hard to narrow down. We have huge amounts of data. So it's a complete different mindset. We need to work with that data and find patterns. Find maybe patterns of communication between bacteria, interaction between bacteria, and see how that translates into human health. So, for example, we may know this specific bacteria that when this bacteria is present, then this other bacteria is not present. So we start building these networks, and then we test a treatment, a prebiotic, a probiotic, and see how that impacts that network, and then we see how it translates into human health, into an effect.
And do you do this by just growing your own bacteria, or are you taking, in your lab, you're taking bacteria from?
So we analyze bacteria from a lot of different types of samples. But, of course, the gut bacteria, the type of sample that we use the most is stool samples. So stool samples are like liquid gold for us because they're a source of so many different bacteria and tell us so much about health. So that's most of what we process in the core. We get samples and we isolate the nucleic acid, DNA, RNA, and then we sequence everything that is there. And from there, we use a lot of bioinformatics, and we get to conclusions of patterns and things that go up and things that go down and things that are impacted by different treatments and how that works.
Yeah, this is incredibly exciting. We only have a couple minutes left.
Okay.
I want to just like ask you like a million questions, but I'm gonna focus on one or two here. Quickly, tell us what your thoughts are on people taking probiotics before or after antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard about, been asked about, for people who perhaps have their gut kind of wiped out and aren't responding to the typical treatments, these infusions of bacteria into their colon of these isolation. Tell us about those two things. Is this science fiction or is it real?
This is completely real. So the second thing is fecal microbiota transplantation. It has been...
Fecal transplants, they're called.
Yes.
Okay.
So those are incredibly successful for patients that have C. diff infections, and they work in over 70% of cases. They have problems like, you know, it's very hard when you have something that you don't really know that you are actually putting in another person. And then with probiotics, yes, I do take probiotics when I take antibiotics, although I haven't taken antibiotics in I don't know how many years. But my daughters have, and when they have ear infections, and we do give them probiotics. They need to be kept in the dark. They need to be refrigerated. You need to have a very high doses, a lot of different strains, a lot of different species, and they have to have a very late expiration date. So all of that you need to check when you go and buy your probiotics, I don't know, in the store.
Well, that's a really great practical guide.
it's an excellent guide. So many people use probiotics, and there's so many different products on the shelf. That's excellent information. Thank you.
Sure.
You know, I guess maybe the last two questions here. You know, what do you hope is the next kind of major breakthrough that you kind of say, I wouldn't be surprised if X happens a year, 2 years from now, 5 years from now in this field? And then what would be your final practical tip for consumers?
This is very exciting because it's already happening. It's not, you know, in 2 or 3 or 5 years. It's happening. That interface between host, bacteria, and the communication between the two. For example, there was a paper that came out, I think it was a month ago, where they correlated the lactase gene, which is, you know, a gene that allows us to digest lactose, to eat dairy, with the presence of bifidobacterium. So that's happening now. This is a bacteria that is correlated with a human trait. And this, I'm excited to see more of that, you know, how we communicate with bacteria and how they modulate us as we modulate them.
And what would you be your final tip for our listeners?
They should not be afraid of bacteria. Forget about hand sanitizers. Bacteria are good for you. At least 99.9% of bacteria are good for you. Of course, you're going to get sick because that happens. But I think that's the best advice I can give.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your advice with your health listeners. We've been talking with Dr. Andrea Ascarati-Perro, the director of UNC's Microbiome Research Corps, about her research on the human microbiome. Thank you so much for being a guest on Your Health.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Leah and I are going to spend a few minutes hearing and responding to your health concerns. And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about someone who thinks it's a silly question, but we think it's an important issue. Laura?
I know it's probably silly, but when I go to my doctor, I get self-conscious when I have to report my lifestyle habits on my intake forms, such as number of drinks per week and smoking habits. Is my doctor judging me when she looks at my answers?
Well, I don't think this is a silly question. I think this is something that probably all of us think about when we go to the doctor. I know I do.
I do. And I also understand how it can be a bit uncomfortable to talk about things that are so personal.
You know, I think, you know, if you are in the habit of having a glass of wine at dinner, well, we know there's good data that a glass of wine once a day might actually lower some of your risk of heart disease. But a doctor, you may think, might be worried, oh my goodness gracious, they may think that's a lot more, particularly if a doctor never drinks any wine, and you think, oh, should I say that or not say that? And so we start to think about these things. The good news is doctors are human, but we're also trained to do assessments and to know when something is problematic. So in this particular case, I think if you use any tobacco use, that's a problem. There is no safe threshold. So that would be something you'd want your doctor to know about. If you are drinking very moderately, which could be one drink, a couple drinks a week, that's probably okay in most cases, and it's probably okay to talk about that if you're drinking a lot more than that. Your doctor should know about that. I don't know other thoughts you have, Leah, when you go to the doctor, what it's like to be honest, or maybe thinking like, should I be honest?
I think it's very important to be transparent with your doctor. I understand it may be uncomfortable, but full disclosure is very important because the ultimate goal is to have good health.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's maybe you don't want it written down, but maybe you want to have a conversation. Maybe say, hey, no, I don't want to answer this because here's why. And that opens up the conversation, which we both encourage you to have. Thank you so much for that question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 60-year-old man who recently started on blood thinners. Now I bruise all the time. Is this something I should be concerned about?
Well, I think that anyone is concerned when they have bruises on their body. As a doctor, you know, we look at it and say, where did that bruise come from? And I recall someone just recently who said that they had bruises and they wanted to know. One of the first questions I ask is, are you, let's say, taking aspirin? In this particular case, then perhaps they're on a blood thinner called Coumadin. And I don't know about you, Leah, but I know that a lot of people that tell me when they're on aspirin and patients that I see, they do bruise. And aspirin it inhibits platelets and can cause bruising. That part is not so worrisome. And I suspect when you've fallen off your bike at some point in time, you get a pretty significant bruise. You're not worried because you know what the cause of it is.
Exactly. I know what the cause it is. If you do have bruising that you don't know the cause, definitely bring that up with your physician. Taking certain medications, as you can see on their insert, that they're going to have certain side effects, which might be bruising in your case with the blood thinners, but not to be alarmed. And if you do get alarmed, certainly open that conversation up with your physician.
Yeah, I think in this case, probably bring it up with your physician. It sounds like good advice. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a runner in my mid-30s, and I've noticed recently that I have the beginnings of a bunion. To say the least, it's not very comfortable. I've tried wider shoes and a brace, but is there anything else I should do to prevent it from worsening?
Well, bunions are tough. I think these are one of the more difficult things. And like most problems with excessive wear on the foot, corns, calluses, bunions, even warts at times, these are difficult things that require really working with a provider who knows and does some work treating feet and is willing to work with you. You know, you're an athlete, Leah, so you probably have seen or at least have come across these sorts of foot issues.
Yes, I have. I've had my own foot issues, and I've actually gone to see a specialist, and I found that very helpful, a podiatrist in particular, for my own issues with my foot.
So podiatrist actually is a really good idea for a lot of folks. Sometimes they'll actually look to help you with inserts in the shoes that might alter the pressure points for where these things might form. Certainly, I always just look at the shoes. A lot of times getting new shoes and different shoes really can be helpful. So we know this is difficult. Thank you for your question, and I hope you're on the path to having improved foot health. Alar, what's our very last house call?
I think my mother's memory is declining. She and my father have been married for 60 years, and my father covers for her a lot. I don't think anything dangerous is going on, but I'm wondering if I should address it with her doctor.
Oh, this is a really difficult question, but a really important question, and thank you for raising this issue. I think the concern about memory loss in a parent is one that a lot of us will face at some point in time in our life. We're blessed to have parents that are living long enough. So raising that question gives us a chance to at least think about how we might approach it. What are some thoughts, Leah?
Well, for my parents, I think it would be very important to bring it to attention again of a physician just to have my parent checked out. There may be some medications that could improve memory that, if taken early enough, would change the trajectory of my parents' life and memory. So I would want to be on top of that.
Yeah, I think we even talked about at some point in time in the not-too-distant past about some research that might actually stimulate memory and improvements. And there could be medications that our loved one is on that actually are making the memory worse. Sometimes these medications for depression or anxiety could be inhibiting, or it could be depression masking as memory issues. At the very least, getting a diagnosis and getting it to the attention, I couldn't agree with you more, Leah, is the first step. And, you know, congratulate the parents on the long relationship they've had and knowing that your father's doing a great job there. And this isn't a judgment issue. That'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-host today, Dr. Leah Ranney, and our guest today, Dr. Andrea Ascarati-Perro. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. And on behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL. presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.